This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Hafiz Khan.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Mathalul ladhina yunfiquna amwalahum fi sabilillah كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel launches airstrikes on the Gaza Strip amid tensions following its air raids on Lebanon that prompted Hezbollah's retaliatory rocket attacks. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations calls on the Security Council to reject Israel's deceptions and confront its adventurism in the region. A former New York State employee files a complaint against Governor Andrew Cuomo over sexual harassment amid calls on the embattled politician to resign. That's also in the headlines. Thank you for joining us. Our top story: Israeli aircraft have carried out fresh attacks on the Gaza Strip, targeting areas in the town of Jabalia. We were earlier joined by our correspondent in Gaza, Ashraf Shannon. He gave us an update on the latest round of aggression by the Israeli regime.
Well, Israeli fighter jets attacked a Hamas security post in the northern Gaza Strip, town of Jabalia, minutes after midnight, causing extensive damage to that security post and also to nearby homes. Meanwhile, Israeli fighter jets continue to fly at low altitude in the skies of the Gaza Strip. The Israeli regime claims that the air attacks were retaliation for incendiary balloons that were dispatched from the Gaza Strip earlier. Many here believe that Israel will continue such attacks against the Palestinians in Gaza because of the apathy of the international community, and also because of the fact that Arab countries, especially in the Persian Gulf region, have normalized their ties with Israel, given the Israeli regime the green light to further violate the rights of Palestinians. And to understand, it's been almost 2 months since Israel ended its 11-day onslaught against the Gaza Strip, killing and maiming hundreds of Palestinians in this impoverished enclave and destroying thousands of residential units.
The United States has called on the Lebanese government to prevent Hezbollah and the resistance movement from firing rockets into Israel. The call by the U.S. State Department comes after Hezbollah's deputy chief, Sheikh Naim Qasim, said the movement is prepared to hit Israel again if the regime launches new attacks on Lebanon. Hezbollah fired dozens of rockets at open areas around the Israeli-occupied Sheba farms on Friday. Hezbollah says the rocket fire was in response to Israel's airstrikes. Lebanon's parliament speaker backed Hezbollah's move, saying Israel only understands the language of unity and resistance. The caretaker prime minister also called on the United Nations to pressure Israel to stop its aggression. Overnight and on Wednesday, Israeli warplanes carried out airstrikes, which Tel Aviv claimed were in response to an earlier rocket fire from Lebanon. Author and Middle East expert Kevin Barrett says the U.S. government is in fact dominated by Israel's policies and its propaganda campaign.
In fact, it should be the Lebanese government, of which Hezbollah is part, calling on Washington to stop its unconditional support for Israeli aggression. Unfortunately, the American government is largely dominated by the Israeli government. They put the aggressor in the position of the defender and the defender in the position of the aggressor. And this is the way it's always been with the Zionist propagandists. So nobody takes this seriously, what comes out of the mouth of somebody like Biden or this administration.
Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip have welcomed Hezbollah's rocket attacks, meanwhile, on Israel in response to Israeli airstrikes on Lebanon. They have stressed the importance of maintaining their unity in the face of Israeli crimes in the region. Ruba Shavit has more from the besieged Gaza Strip.
Palestinian groups in the Gaza Strip hailed the Hezbollah's move to fire a parade of rockets toward the Israeli regime in response to Thursday Israeli air raids on South Lebanon. Palestinians welcomed the move, describing it as a strong message to Israel.
The Lebanese rockets foiled Israeli plans and projects aimed at separating the resistance in the region. It proved that the resistance won't remain silent in the face of the Israeli crimes. The Lebanese response is a message that Israel cannot impose its policies in the region, and the resistance will keep defending its rights.
The Israeli military said its Iron Dome system intercepted 10 of 19 rockets on Friday, with six falling in open areas in a third day of tension across the borders. There have been no reports of casualties or serious damage. Palestinian groups expressed their support to all forms of resistance against Israel and announced their readiness to stand with the resistance movement in Lebanon in defending their rights.
We hail the response of the resistance in Lebanon against Israeli airstrikes. This Lebanese move emphasizes the importance of the resistance in defending its rights and foiling the Israeli policies. The Israeli regime is also still practicing all forms of violence against the Islamic and Arab nations, and the resistance is the only way to put an end to these crimes.
The resistance said it won't allow the Israeli regime to impose new policies in the region and that Israel won't go unpunished for its crimes.
We really welcome the Lebanese move to respond to the Israeli airstrikes in South Lebanon and fire rockets at the occupied territories. We stress that we are all united in resistance to liberating Palestine and getting the Israeli occupation away from the region. We are supporting our brothers in Lebanon, and we are all ready to defend any Israeli aggression against Lebanon.
Palestinian factions here welcome the Lebanese response against the Israeli attacks, stressing on fully supporting the resistance in Lebanon against the Israeli aggression with all means. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has called on the Security Council to reject Israel's deceptions and confront its adventurism in the region. In a tweet, Majid Takhtar Avanchi noted that the Israeli regime and its allies made an abortive attempt to present fake information on the Mercer Street tanker incident to the council. The U.S. has claimed that evidence shows last week's attack on the Israeli-managed tanker was conducted by a drone made in Iran. The foreign ministers of the G7 have echoed the claim, first made by Israel. Iran has rejected the allegation, saying Israel is trying to divert world attention from its crimes and inhumane practices in the region. Tel Aviv says it is ready to strike Iran in retaliation for the attack. Iran has warned of a crushing response to any such move. Political commentator Alexander Zadigan says Israel has resorted to deception to wage a war against Iran.
What is really going on is the Israelis are implementing their old tactic of waging war through deception. Many people believe this was Mossad's logo, but it's not correct. Nevertheless, the Israelis are very keen on starting wars under false flag operations in order to pursue their foreign policy. I mean, they haven't really provided any evidence, and in previous situations where we asked for evidence, journalists, investigative journalists, they said we can't disclose the evidence.
A former New York State employee has filed a complaint against Governor Andrew Cuomo over sexual harassment, increasing the possibility he might be charged. The woman has not been named, but is said to work as an aide to Cuomo. She said the three-term governor assaulted her at his executive mansion last year. Her allegation is part of an explosive report released this week that said Cuomo sexually harassed 11 former and current state employees. At least five district attorneys have since opened inquiries into Cuomo's behavior. The 63-year-old Democrat has repeatedly denied ever touching a woman inappropriately. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security has warned of a growing threat of violence from supporters of former President Donald Trump. The department said it has witnessed an increasing but modest level of activity online by those who call for violence over claims of fraud in the presidential election last year. It says there is no information yet on specific plots, but some actions may happen during August. The administration of President Joe Biden has already warned about the rising threats of militias and white supremacists in the coming months. The warnings about possible domestic terrorism come against the backdrop of the storming of the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. by pro-Trump mobs on January 6. Trump's fans burst into Congress in an attempt to overturn his election defeat. The incident left five people dead. Democratic senators and families of the 9/11 victims call on U.S. President Joe Biden to declassify documents detailing Saudi Arabia's role in the terrorist attacks. The families say Biden has failed to fulfill his campaign promise to release the information on the 2001 attacks. They say 20 years after the attacks, there is simply no reason to keep this information secret. The group has threatened to publicly stand against the Biden administration's participation in next month's memorial ceremonies unless the information is released. Meanwhile, the chair of the Senate's Foreign Affairs Committee, backed the push, Bob Menendez, said the bereaved families have a right to know if the government is sitting on documents implicating Saudi Arabia or others in the attacks. 15 of the 19 9/11 attackers were Saudi nationals. Back in 2004, a commission found charities funded by the Saudi government likely supported the attacks. The Bolivian president has pledged to punish those accused by the government of an alleged coup in 2019 when former leader Evo Morales lost power.
We will not stop demanding the prosecution and punishment of the perpetrators of the coup d'etat, who must be brought to justice for the illegal, illegitimate, and violent acts they committed against the people, democracy, and the political constitution of the state.
Luis Arce added that every effort should be made to end the political crisis caused by those who staged the coup in collusion with international accomplices to repress Bolivians. Morales stepped down as president in November 2019 after weeks of protests against his re-election. Morales quit after losing the support of the military amid an alleged electoral fraud. His resignation was followed by clashes between his supporters and security forces, which left dozens dead. Conservative Jeanine Añez assumed the interim presidency until new elections were held. The UN Special Envoy for Afghanistan says the country is heading towards a, quote, catastrophe, calling on the Taliban to cease their attacks on major cities immediately.
In the past weeks, the war in Afghanistan has entered a new, deadlier, and more destructive phase. The Taliban campaign during June and July to capture rural areas has achieved significant territorial gains. From this strengthened position, they have begun to attack the larger cities.
While briefing the UN Security Council, the envoy said more than 1,000 Afghan civilians have been killed in the past month. She also questioned the Taliban's commitment to a political settlement, saying the militants know that further bloodshed will only complicate the reconciliation process. Lyons urged the Security Council to press the warring sides to stop fighting and join the negotiating table. This comes after the Taliban took control of Zaranj in Nemruz province. This is the first provincial capital to fall to the militants, who have been fighting government forces in several big cities. Pakistan's fugitive former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif is in hot water after Britain decided to expel him. Sharif has been staying there for nearly 2 years now, despite court orders urging him to return home and serve a 10-year prison term on money laundering charges.
Britain is known to be the hub of terrorist and corrupt fugitive political leaders fled from Pakistan. This is London residence of Altaf Hussain, a leader of Karachi-based ethnic political party. Back home, Hussain was convicted on terrorism and murder charges. Nonetheless, UK never handed him back to Pakistan of being what many believe an intelligence asset of British secret services. This is Ishaq Dar, the former finance minister who fled from Pakistan in 2018 to avert prosecution on money laundering charges. And here comes the former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, who has been staying in these luxurious flats, which judges back in Pakistan found were purchased with the looted public money. However, pressure from Islamabad has now compelled Britain to change its long-held pro-fugitive policy after London decided to expel Nawaz Sharif. His request to further stay in the UK was rejected by Britain. His Pakistani passport is already invalid after Islamabad refused to renew it.
The UK government has been under intense pressure, not only from Pakistan, but various other countries whose fugitive leaders have been living in UK for a long period of time. UK government was under great pressure and under great criticism. And that could be a reason that the UK government basically did not allow Nawaz Sharif to stay on or extend the visa of Nawaz Sharif to stay in UK.
Nawaz Sharif fled Pakistan after plundering public exchequer. He should now come back to Pakistan and must return the money he looted, and after this he can comfortably stay at his home in Pakistan.
Sharif was convicted and sentenced for 10 years on money laundering charges, but was released from jail in November 2019 only for medical treatment for a few weeks. However, since then, he has been residing in London despite repeated court orders to return home to face trial of corruption cases. The former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif is fast running out of his legal and political options after Britain decided to expel him. One of the choices, analysts believe, is to seek shelter in an Arab country after exhausting his all legal options to delay his expulsion from the UK. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The conflict in Ethiopia's flashpoint Tigray state escalates as rebels rebuff a federal government call to pull out of recently captured areas in the region. The government accuses forces loyal to Tigray's People's Liberation Front of threatening the June ceasefire. The foreign ministry said the rebels were pushing the government to change its defensive mood. It also warned that Addis Ababa could deploy, quote, the entire defensive capability of the state if a peaceful resolution is not reached. The rebels have taken control of several areas of Afar and Amhara regions in recent weeks, claiming they are trying to break the government's blockade on Tigray. The state has been the scene of fighting between the federal army and forces and rebels since last November. Hundreds of people have been killed and tens of thousands of others displaced. Brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. Oh, the most merciful.
In the limelight.
Vaccinating adolescents could have a significant impact on reducing transmission in schools and reduce the educational disruption that children have suffered over the past 18 months. We now present you an article written jointly by Dipti Gurdasani and John Henley. The piece is titled Why are UK government experts holding off vaccinating under 16s in the UK? Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation, JCVI, announced recently that everyone in the United Kingdom aged 16 and 17 should be offered the COVID-19 vaccine. Just several days ago, it said the vaccine wouldn't be offered to non-vulnerable people aged between 12 and 17. The change in position is welcome, but the reasons for the committee's two-week delay and its decision to not extend the vaccine to 12 to 15-year-olds are unclear. Unlike the US Center for Disease Control, the CDC, the committee has offered no quantitative analysis of the risk associated with vaccinating people in this younger age group. Delaying the rollout of the vaccine to adolescents is risky. Recent figures show that 1% of 10-year-old to 19-year-olds were being diagnosed with COVID-19 a week. Waiting for further data on vaccine safety when infections are ripping through younger age groups isn't cautious, it's reckless. This seems particularly clear given what we already know about the safety of vaccines in adolescents. The UK Medicines Healthcare Products and Regulatory Authority claimed the Pfizer vaccine safe and effective for 16 and 17-year-olds in December of 2020, and stated that the benefits of this vaccine outweigh any risk when approving it for 12 to 15-year-olds in June of this year. In the United States, where officials claimed close to 9 million adolescents aged between 12 and 17 have been fully vaccinated, the Center for Disease Control, the CDC, has unambiguously recommended vaccines for those aged 12 and above. Worryingly, the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunizations recent announcement that only recommended the first dose of the vaccine for 16 to 17-year-olds, millions of adolescents in this age group have been vaccinated with two doses in the United States and in other countries, and we know that full protection from the Delta variant of the coronavirus depends critically on receiving two jabs. So much data on this is already available. It's unclear why the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization needs yet more data to make an assessment that many countries made months ago. The choice in the United Kingdom now is between infection and vaccination. Given the high rates of infection among young people in the United Kingdom, there is little doubt that the benefits of vaccines far outweigh the risks. Vaccines also reduce the burden of long COVID by protecting people against infection. The Office for National Statistics, the ONS, which has regularly followed up with thousands of people across the United Kingdom who have had COVID-19, finds that persistent illness is common, about 8% after infection among children. For many of those who become infected, COVID-19 is not a minor illness. Recently, the Office for National Statistics, the ONS, estimates suggests that around 20,000 children aged under the age of 17 with long COVID currently suffer from its impact on their day-to-day lives. Some 7,000 children have been living with this for more than a year. Although only a few children may develop severe symptoms as a result of COVID-19, if thousands of children are infected, the number who become seriously ill can quickly stack up. It's puzzling that those who are nervous about vaccinating children due to the risk of extremely rare and typically minor side effects are not equally concerned about exposing children to a novel virus. We know that COVID-19 causes poorly understood multi-system long-term disease, even in young adults with mild infection, as associated with thinning of brain gray matter. We also know it causes long-term neurological effects among hospitalized children, some of which may be permanent. High rates of infection among adolescents and younger people reflect the spread of the Delta variant of the coronavirus, particularly in schools, where few safety measures have been put in place. Vaccinating adolescents could have a significant impact on reducing transmission in schools and reduce the educational disruption that children have suffered over the past 18 months. Reports from frontline clinicians across the globe suggest that more children are being seen in hospitals as a result of the Delta variant of the coronavirus and that more are requiring intensive care support. Meanwhile, six European Union states have now fully inoculated a larger share of their total populations with the coronavirus vaccine than the United Kingdom, after the bloc's dire initial rollout took off, while Britain's impressive early jab rate has slumped. According to government and health service figures collated by the online science publication Our World in Data, Malta, Belgium, Spain, Portugal, Denmark, and Ireland have all overtaken the United Kingdom in terms of the percentages of their populations who are fully vaccinated. While Britain's campaign was bound to slow first as it ran into harder-to-reach, more vaccine-hesitant groups, the rate of decline is dramatic. Britain is currently administering a fraction of the daily doses of some European Union states. For example, on Wednesday, 4th of August, France administered 368,596 first doses of the vaccine and 261,695 second doses of the vaccine, while Britain's totals were 33,304 and 165,669 respectively. The data will put pressure on Boris Johnson's government to reboot a program that began supposedly as one of the world's fastest but is now flagging, with 57.3% of the population fully jabbed and 69% partly vaccinated. Vaccination rates are rising only very slowly in every age group in the United Kingdom, but low take-up in the 18 to 29 cohort, due mainly to a perception that young people are not at risk, is marked and has alarmed ministers. Among the 18 to 30-year-olds, an estimated 33% or one-third are yet to get their first shot of the vaccine. According to the figures, Malta had fully vaccinated 88% of its total population by 4th of August, with 91% having had at least one dose of the vaccine. Belgium is on 61% fully jabbed and 70% partially jabbed. Spain on 60% fully jabbed and 70% partially jabbed. Portugal on 59% and 70%. Denmark on 58% and 73%, and Ireland on 57.4% and 68%. The gap appears likely to widen further, since several European Union states, while their rollouts have also slowed since June, are still administering both first and second doses significantly faster than the United Kingdom, whose first dose rate in particular has plummeted. The Netherlands is already ahead of the United Kingdom on first doses, while others, including France, are on course on current trends to overtake Britain on second doses shortly. According to Our World in Data, the European Union's 27 rolling 7-day average of daily doses per 100 people is currently 0.56 shots, almost double the UK's rate of 0.28 shots. Some European Union states are vaccinating faster than the bloc's average, and many times faster than Britain. For example, Denmark is managing a rolling 7-day average of 0.97 daily doses per 100 people, France 0.82, Belgium 0.80, Portugal and Ireland 0.77, Spain 0.73 and Italy 0.72. With a rapid spread of the Delta variant of the coronavirus adding a new urgency to its slowing vaccine drive, France is one of several European Union countries to have adopted the kind of coercive tactics aimed at boosting take-up among vaccine-shy groups, including young people, that the British government has so far appeared reluctant to consider. Denmark, Italy, Greece, and most recently Germany have all adopted or mooted similar tough incentives to get vaccinated, while multiple European Union countries have also boosted take-up by opening up their vaccination offer to all over 12-year-olds, some since mid-June. In March, as Britain's vaccine rollout powered ahead, the World Health Organization, WHO, compared its unfavorable with Europe's, which is criticized as unacceptably slow. However, success is far from even across the bloc. Poorer member states such as Romania and Bulgaria, with less well-endowed public health services than wealthier neighbors such as Germany and the Netherlands, are struggling, with barely 26% and 15% of their respective populations vaccinated with at least one dose of the vaccine.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates. Their once closely coordinated relationship is now fraying as a cascade of disagreements has emerged between them, especially over the past few months. As external factors such as the 2011 uprisings brought Saudi Arabia and the UAE together, changes in regional and global geopolitics are now putting their interests at odds, periodically turning them against each other. the Saudi-Emirati relationship went into overdrive amidst the 2011 protests that rocked political establishments across the Arab world. Their closer alliance was a serious attempt to build up a unified front against any revolutionary movement in the region. To some extent, it was this fear of revolution and those who fanned its flames that finally resulted in the blockade of Qatar in 2017. Spearheaded by Riyadh and Abu Dhabi, the blockade meant to dissuade Doha from supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, a movement considered by many as the main force behind what they call the Arab Spring. The rapid rise of young Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia and his close friendship with the ambitious Crown Prince of the UAE made the two countries take a more adventurous, aggressive path in the region.
We have to know that the relationship between Saudi Arabia, represented by MBS, Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and the Emirate, represented by MBZ or MBZ, Mohammed bin Zayed, those countries' relationship are based on the friendship of their respective rulers. And now, after like a honeymoon, long honeymoon, this honeymoon is coming to an end.
The immediate result was a bloody campaign against the poorest country in the region, under the excuse of reinstating the fugitive president of Yemen. All these factors, along with the enmity with Iran, kept the two Arab powers close to each other for about 10 years. But now the so-called Arab Spring has largely passed, and revolutionary sentiment appears mostly on the margins of the internet than in street protest. As anti-state challenges began to fade, a split of opinions began to appear on how to deal with pro-revolutionary groups like the Muslim Brotherhood and, by extension, Qatar. In January 2021, Riyadh announced the end of the blockade on Qatar, a move Abu Dhabi didn't welcome warmly. The Emiratis have yet to restore a full-time ambassador to Doha. In Yemen, strategic realities have also begun to set in. At first, the Emiratis and the Saudis were equally committed to fighting with the Ansarullah movement. But as the war went on, Abu Dhabi decided that the war was more a Saudi problem and therefore became less willing to expend the troops and treasure on the campaign. The decision consequently led to a certain amount of bad blood between the two sides. Things could turn for the worse in Yemen, especially as the UAE-backed Southern Transitional Council continues to seek secession from Yemen, which Saudi Arabia wants to keep unified. Meanwhile, the two countries' attempts to diversify their oil-dependent economies have triggered a kind of economic friction. In tourism, Saudi Arabia hopes to copy Dubai's luxury lure and, if possible, overtake it. With similar climates and attractions, Saudi Arabia and the UAE have found themselves in a fierce rivalry in attracting tourists. Mega projects such as Jeddah Tower and the futuristic town of Neom have been designed to lure businesses and workers away from the glitzy malls of Dubai. Saudi Arabia is also pursuing new transport and infrastructure projects, threatening well-established Emirati companies. Its new national airline, for instance, is striving to muscle out Dubai's Emirates airline market share. The Saudis are also growing ports along the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf, hoping to unseat Jebel Ali on the southern outskirts of Dubai, which acts as the logistical linchpin between Asia and Europe.
It's not new, but publicly now it's in the open. But before, no, it wasn't. It's not new. It's like started by differences since the war in Yemen, and who is in the lead, who wants to be in the lead. And secondly, one sanction opposed on Qatar also, or the relations between Jebel Ali, especially, or Emirate, and trading with Iran.
there were like so many differences between Emirates and Saudi Arabia, but now it comes to an open publicly.
In February 2021, Saudi Arabia warned it would terminate state contracts with businesses that didn't have their regional headquarters in the kingdom, a desperate act to force them to move from the UAE.
This will weaken the Emirates' economy, and especially when Saudi Arabia asked the big international companies to come back from Emirates, and because Saudi Arabia is much wider and bigger, let's say, merchant for investors to invest. So this will, economic-wise, will bother Emirates a lot.
A few months later, in July 2021, Riyadh imposed tariffs on goods produced in free zones or with Israeli involvement, policy decisions that directly affect the free zone heavy, Israel-friendly United Arab Emirates. A more overt attempt by Riyadh to limit the Emirates' gains from normalization with Israel. On the other hand, at OPEC, the Emiratis have been more willing to break with the Saudis to gain the production level they want, a sign of growing rift between the two sides.
Saudi Arabia is saying that by extending the oil production, the oil price will go down. And we need it to be stable. And that's why you have OPEC Plus, like the 22 countries is like with Saudi Arabia in this manner. But Emirates has another point of view. They said, okay, we lost so much like money and our economy is a little bit tight, so we need to extend our oil production, like increase our portion of oil production daily. But that will make the oil price, as according to Saudi opinion, will make the oil price go down again. This is the main problem, main issue. So it's also economic-wise, and it is related, especially when UAE is very related economy to the oil production. It's like more than 30% of its economy depends on oil production.
As the UAE-Saudi axis deteriorates, so has the hard line against Iran. Bin Salman's language in Iran has softened dramatically since his rise as the Saudi crown prince. Likewise, the UAE has been busy patching up with Iran. All in all, the growing divergence of interests between Riyadh and Abu Dhabi has created serious cracks in the thin layer of their strategic entente, as it used to be hailed. Although the two sides might continue to agree on some major strategic matters, Riyadh and Abu Dhabi are expected to chart different courses in the coming decade. In fact, overlapping economic competition and strategic differences have already marked an end to a decade of unprecedented alliance.
In the limelight.
Early in the pandemic, in the scramble to create tools to study SARS-CoV-2, investigators developed pseudo-virus systems to measure infection in a safe, easily quantifiable way. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Heiren Cho and Michael Farzan, researchers. This article is published under the heading How SARS-CoV-2 First Adapted in Humans. Stay tuned for more. Viruses need entry proteins to penetrate the cells where they will replicate. The severe acute respiratory syndrome coronavirus 2 SARS-CoV-2 version is called the spike or S protein. The S protein, also target of the current vaccines, is quickly adapting to its new human host. It took its first major step in this direction early in 2020 when its amino acid 614 changed from an aspartic acid to a glycine. Viruses bearing this D614 G mutation transmit among humans more rapidly and now form the majority in circulation. Early in the pandemic, in the scramble to create tools to study SARS-CoV-2, investigators developed pseudovirus systems to measure infection in a safe, easily quantifiable way. These systems express a viral entry protein on the surface of a reporter virus used to monitor cell entry and have been used for years to study many such proteins, including the S protein of classic SARS-CoV-1. Frustratingly, pseudoviruses built from the SARS-CoV-2 S protein produce much lower signals than those based on the very similar SARS-CoV-1 S protein. This was perplexing because biochemical studies of SARS-CoV-1 and SARS-CoV-2 S protein receptor binding domains RBDs made clear that the SARS-CoV-2 RBD bound their common receptor, angiotensin converting enzyme 2, with higher affinity than that of SARS-CoV-1. Faced with inefficient assays, many virologists landed on the same solution as their structural biology colleagues. Mutate the S protein site that is cleaved by ferrin-like proteases in virus-producing cells. This change kept the S protein S1 domain, which contains the RBD and binds ACE2, covalently linked to its S2 domain, which anchors the S protein to the virion. Notably, some but not all of these ferrin site mutations significantly improved pseudovirus infection of cells. This fix solved a technical problem, but it deepened a mystery. Although a number of distantly related coronaviruses carry ferrin cleavage sites at their S1, S2 boundaries, the SARS-CoV-1 S protein and those of all known bat-derived viruses from the same SARB virus lineage lack this site. Instead of being cleaved in virus-producing cells, their S proteins are cleaved by different proteases while the virus is engaging ACE2 in the next yet-to-be-infected cell. As it happened, ferrin site mutations that improved SARS-CoV-2 S protein function in pseudoviruses allowed the modified S protein to work with these later-stage enzymes, just like the SARS-CoV-1 version. Why then did the SARS-CoV-2 ferrin site persist, even though it made infection in cell culture less efficient? Indeed, viruses passaged in culture regularly lost this site. Does it somehow improve viral transmission? Would it eventually disappear over the course of the pandemic? In the summer of 2020, Korber et al. Sounded an alarm about a mutation of concern, namely D614G. In the lab, this change obviated the need to eliminate the S-protein ferrin site, apparently correcting a design flaw associated with this unusual cleavage site. Animal studies with otherwise identical viruses showed markedly greater replication of the B614G variant in the upper respiratory tract, a site important for transmission. By contrast, no significant differences between the two viruses were seen in the lower respiratory tract, a site responsible for more severe disease. These observations are consistent with the current consensus that the 614G now present in most circulating viruses enhances viral transmission, but unlike more recent acquired transmissions in S1, it does not change the rate of hospitalizations. The underlying mechanism for this fitness advantage remained a point of controversy. Here, a second unusual property of the S-protein, in this case shared with SARS-CoV-1, became relevant. The SARS-CoV-2 S-protein, like most interproteins of viruses, with a lipid membrane assembles into trimers. Typically, during the process of virion assembly, viral interproteins subtly change their confrontations. But it is unusual for these proteins to break their threefold symmetry before they bind their receptor. However, the mature SARS-CoV-2 S-protein often assumes an asymmetrical arrangement whereby one of its three RBDs assumes an open or up conformation. Only RBDs in this up conformation can bind ACE2. Once it does so, the S1 domain dissociates from S2, and S2 undergoes a pronounced rearrangement to a post-fusion state. The release energy of this rearrangement drives the viral and cell membranes to fuse and gives the virus access to the cell interior. To explain the 614G fitness, some investigators focus on the impact of the 614G on the frequency with which this one-up conformation could be found, suggesting that more efficient engagement of the receptor accounted for the enhanced transmissibility of viruses bearing this mutation. Other scientists noted that S-proteins of the 614G-expressing viruses fell apart less frequently, an effect perhaps amplified in the challenging environment of a living organism. They observed that the 614G helped the S1 domain cling to S2, preventing S2 from prematurely and unproductively assuming its post-fusion conformation. Thus, the virus had more functional S-proteins that could bind and infect the next cell. To cut through this controversy, Zhang, the expert in this domain, solved the structure and provided detailed analysis of both the 614 and G614 S-proteins in multiple states. They first noted that, as they and others had previously observed, the loss of the 614 in S1 breaks an ionic bond to a proximal lysine, K854 in S2. Loss of this salt bridge is initially counterintuitive because it will loosen the association between S1 and S2, although it might ease the movement of the RBD into the up configuration. However, the structures from Zhang et al. Show that a major difference between S-proteins with and without D614G is the visibly greater ordering in G614S proteins of a region spanning residence 602 to 640, which authors call the 630 loop. This loop is just downstream of G614.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.